Perhaps, Christoph, you'd like to start off by introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure, yeah. I'm Christoph Teuscher. I'm currently working at UCSD in San Diego, and I'm a computer scientist. I'm interested basically in, well, in one sentence, how can we make machines more lifelike? That means, like, how can we build more complex, more robust machines that are more similar to what we see in biology. So I'm kind of interested in the field that is at the interface between computer science and biology, cognitive science, and including nanotech and stuff like that.
Great, thank you so much. On your website, I thought this sort of summed it up nicely. On your website, you state, "My ambition is to create machines that show lifelike behavior and characteristics." Could you talk a little about what this means to you and what methods you use to pursue it?
Yeah, that's a little bit ill-defined probably in general. So when you take a look at like humans or animals, one of the most striking things is probably the fact that humans and animals are really able to learn in a more or less open fashion without restrictions, and that's something machines can't do, or at least it's very hard for them to get to a level where we're even close to a simple animal. So that's something we want to achieve with machines. As an example, learn in an open-ended fashion, adapt to an ever-changing environment. If you have a robot that runs in a maze, for example, even if it's a simple maze, he has to constantly adapt to that environment. And mm-hmm. if it gets more complex, he has to adapt again and again. So that's something where machines have a lot of problems, and humans do that, in an innate fashion. So that's one part of that lifelike behavior. You can put a lot of things in there, like, as I said, robustness. When animals and humans do self-repair to a certain limit, and what machines usually don't do, if one of your transistors in your computer fails, then usually the machine is, you can throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
There is certainly redundancy in self-repair to a certain level as well in machines, but usually it's not during the lifetime. It's maybe when they test it after fabrication, things like that. But a computer that constantly self-repairs, for example, we don't have that actually. So that's part of that lifelike. Then, sort of. I also like to say that building perfect machines out of imperfect components, that mm-hmm. is something that nature does very well, and where we have a lot of problems with computers, or in general with artificial things.
So could you tell us about your project BioWall?
Yeah, so the BioWall is it was intended as a demonstrator of biological principles applied to computer science. So what we call that biological inspired computer science. So we're not interested in copying nature per se, but in just drawing inspiration from it.
Mm-hmm.
So the BioWall originally was intended to demonstrate to a larger public the so-called embryonics project. Embryonics means embryonic electronics, so electronics inspired by the embryonic, developmental things a human goes through or animal goes through.
Mm-hmm.
So developing a human or an animal from one cell to a multicellular organism is a very complex thing. And by drawing inspiration from that process, about 10 years ago at EPFL in Lausanne, they started a project with the goal to build robust, self-repairing electronics inspired by the embryonic process in nature. So basically that means that an embryonic machine is composed of a certain number of cells, and each cell is going to contain the entire program of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit similar to the genome we have in each cell. So that makes each cell universal.
So all the cells are identical?
Identical at the beginning, but then the cell differentiates depending on where it is, what it has to do,
mm-hmm.
what its environment is. So, yeah, but it contains the same initial information.
Uh-huh.
So an electronic chip can be considered like a multicellular organism. And when one cell fails, for example, then another cell, a spare cell, can replace that faulty cell. So initially, this embryonic project was just on the a silicon level, so small electronic chips that would go to space or into anywhere where reliability has no price, basically. So, but of course, on a silicon chip, you can see how these self-repair mechanisms, how these cellular differentiation mechanisms, all that stuff works. So
right.
The goal of the BioWall was to make that available to a large public, and then people could touch the machine and destroy molecules and cells and see what happens when something gets wrong. So it was sort of pedagogical goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why this BioWall is so big. It's like 6 meters long.
Yeah, maybe
ton, and so it's really an object for the large public.
Yeah, could you just give a physical description of what the wall looks like?
Yeah, so it looks like a curved wall, 6 meters long, a meter high. The screen is a meter high. The machine itself is about 2 meters high. A ton, so huge, and it's basically, from an engineering's point of view, it's a large screen made up of about 3,200 cells, individual displays, and every display can display two different colors, and every basic element also has a touch-sensitive membrane, so
mm-hmm.
that allows to interact with that machine in a very fine-grained manner.
So
it looks like a screen that you can touch.
And is the appearance sort of fluid, or is it blocky like a grid?
It's like a grid, but that's another aspect there. Even though the size looks fixed, you can add elements, basic elements, on any side of the machine and extend this sort of artificial tissue, electronic tissue, of course. So the entire machine is extendable, basically only limited by the physical, by the number of elements you have at your disposal.
And so each cell, reading through the tech information on the web, it said each cell has the touch sensor, 64 LEDs, and an FPGA?
Exactly, yeah. So what we call, it's a little bit confusing, since for the embryonics project, a cell is composed of a set of molecules. So there are two different levels, and then above the cell you have the level of the organism. So and you can even have like populations of organisms, of course, if you have enough elements available. So the cell, if we're talking about the embryonics project, the cell is a set of molecules, and the molecule is the basic element of the BioWall. And sometimes we call it cell, for example, if it's very straightforward to implement cellular automata on that wall.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, the small element that is composed of a display, a touch-sensitive screen, and an FPGA is called a cell. And an FPGA, by the way, is a field programmable gate array, so that's sort of a reconfigurable processor. When you have a processor, you usually just download a new program, and then the structure of the system, the logic of the system, doesn't change. But with these chips, you can configure the hardware, the logic, function the system is going to compute. So it's lower level.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask why FPGA rather than microcontroller.
Yeah, I mean, you can use the processors as well, but it sort of makes the system more homogeneous and more flexible at the lower level. And the Embryonics project itself was intended to be an FPGA, so it made sense to use these FPGAs and to have a certain flexibility on that level.
And how many cells were in the entire wall?
The biggest wall we put together was 3,200 cells, if I remember right.
That's an amazing amount of computation.
Yeah, it's a really massive parallel machine. And it has approximately the same number of gates as, or at the time, it had the same number of gates as a Pentium 2 processor in terms of computational power. But, of course, it was massively parallel.
Right.
But it wasn't designed as a massive parallel machine, as a supercomputer, which usually requires to have a special communication structure and things like that. So this regular grid was just purely locally interconnected, so that doesn't make a good machine, a good parallel computer for most parallel problems people want to solve. So it's very good for cellular automata-like problems and problems that all already have a cellular decomposition, but not for problems like where you have to have a central controller and stuff like that. There is no central controller at all in that firewall. It's all decentralized.
Could you explain a few of the sort of projects you guys have tested on the wall?
Yeah, so there are a lot of cellular automata-related things like the game of life and different resolutions, and that's very nice, and kids love that. And you can touch the wall and change the state of the cellular automata from 1 to 0 and vice versa just by touching these touch-sensitive membranes, and you really get a sense of that emergent computation. So when you just randomly touch it, it creates all these nice patterns, and it runs for minutes and minutes. So that's one toy application we had. We implemented neural networks and stuff like that, self-replicating loops. So there's a whole bunch of possibilities. We could even display films on that and photos on the wall. But as I said, that wasn't the initial goal. So, the main application was that bio watch, so a self-repairing watch with minutes, hours, and seconds, and then people could kill elements of the machine. Well, not by physically destroying them, but just touching the wall, and they would then see how the machine repairs itself.
For our listeners who excuse me, for our listeners who don't know so much about who don't have such a computational background, could you explain what a cellular automata is?
It's basically a regular grid of extremely simple processing elements that are locally interconnected. So the most straightforward arrangement is a regular grid, and every cell of that grid, every element sees its four neighbors, and depending on the state of the neighbors, the cell itself is going to be in a different state.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the most famous example is Conway's Game of Life. There are different of course you can connect the cells in different ways. You can have different states, not just 1 and 0, but 1, 2, 3, and 4, and different number of states, and things like that. So there's a whole bunch, a whole family of different cellular automata. But the key element, I think, is that the building blocks are extremely simple, are locally interconnected, and have a few states, internal states. It's not like you would put together complex processor like Pentiums or whatever, or power PCs.
Mm-hmm.
They're simple processing elements.
So why do you call it a tissue?
I think we started calling it tissue from the moment we added the touch-sensitive membranes.
Uh-huh.
You can I mean, if it's just a screen, then you can't interact with it. But the touch-sensitive membranes add a new dimension, and you can really interact with that machine, also in a massive parallel manner. And that's something many computers don't have. You mostly use your keyboard and your mouse, but that's like a 50 input channels. And if you have a massive number of inputs, like for the BioWall, it was like 3,200 channels, you might hypothesize that in a complex environment, with all the aspects of embodiment, so that the machine has to be embodied in the environment, more inputs make more sense. So that's one aspect of that.
And where did the idea come from to design this wall?
Oh, the wall? Well, you know, Switzerland is a country of watches and clocks. And so the initial idea was to build a watch, and that was huge, and people wouldn't understand immediately how this thing works. So something simple, understandable. I think that's it.
And
there's nothing more behind it. Like, but we couldn't show to a large public all this microelectronic devices. They wouldn't see anything. So it has to be big and, mm-hmm. and simple and appealing.
Do you feel like the wall was successful in as a research?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was a huge success, and not just for kids who like touch things anyway, but also for adults. And explaining the game of life is one thing, but when you can touch that wall and see what happens, that's totally different. And then the more complex things like the self repair, the aspects of self repair. And even self-replication, which is sort of an extreme case of self-repair. If really everything fails, the organism itself can make a copy and continue running. So I think these are concepts that are not easy to explain. And by means of that wall, I think we made these concepts available to a much larger public. I think it was definitely a huge success.
Do you consider it to be a work of art?
I think so, yeah. It looks nice, and I think that engineers are artists as well. There are many, many similarities. You need to be creative, communicative. It's fascinating. You have to go beyond a specific task. I think it's an artistic work mm-hmm. as well. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Had you done previous work that you considered to be sort of works of art, works of engineering art?
I wouldn't say we've done like artistic work before, but yeah, as I said, engineers are always. Yeah, you might consider engineers as artists in some way. It's a creative process to build machines, and there are beautiful solutions to a problem. There are ugly solutions to a problem, and you always seek the most beautiful solution, the most, maybe not the simple solution, but the best solution. So you want to have your machines look nice, and so I consider that in some way as an artistic beauty. If you want. For the BioWall, we built some prototypes, and we invested a lot of time in like choosing the right colors for the displays, the right size, considering how big the touch-sensitive membranes have to be for people mm-hmm. feel comfortable when touching their machines, things like that. So very practical aspects, and not just the theory behind the machine.
And what are the implications of this project in terms of the sort of greater picture of biological computation?
Well, as I said, it was intended to be a demonstrator for a larger public, so it was not intended to be like a product anyway. But the underlying embryonics project, as I said, like building perfect systems out of imperfect components, building reliable machines, there are tons of applications, and I think it's getting more and more important because machines are getting more complex and they involve more and more components. Of course, it's much cheaper if you can use a huge number of components, and you don't have to test all these components individually, but you can just assemble them in some way and put them together, and the system configures that it uses the good components and the faulty components are not used at all. So in that area, there are really a lot of applications, interesting things going on, especially also in the field of nanotechnology, where usually there are like billions of components involved, and testing is difficult, things like that. So the embryonics project is best seen as a precursor somehow to the field of nanotechnology. Although there is no product per se, there are many, many concepts that are going to be more and more important in the future.
So moving on past BioWall, could you explain the idea of unconventional computing?
Yeah, so in some way, the BioWall is pretty unconventional already. traditional fault-tolerant computing, at least at the very beginning, and even now, many systems just replicate their components. So in an airplane, for example, you might have like three copies of the system you want to have fault-tolerant. And if some system fails, you still have two. So that's something where you add a lot of redundancy that is never going to be used, probably. So the idea of the BioWall to have like cells, and each cell contains the entire program of the machine, and then to have one organism and some spare components, but not like three times the same machine, is of course very interesting. And so that also makes the number of redundant parts, the number of spare parts, scalable. So depending on where your machine goes and on what type of environment you're in, you add a little bit more of redundancy, or you add a little bit less, or whatever. So that's pretty unconventional. But of course, you add like the price you pay is the amount of storage you need to store the program in every cell. So there's a trade-off, of course. So, I think it's that approach to fault-tolerant systems is pretty unconventional. More unconventional, and maybe becoming more important as well, is computers that are not based on silicon chips, but that go far beyond silicon, and by using different substrates like chemical-based computers, maybe nanotechnology, computers based on biological systems, even hybrid systems like it's now possible to grow neurons on silicon, so why not having machines that combine neurons and silicon in a massive, in a much bigger way than all these prototypes do today? So, like, you might imagine, like, having your computer, but in addition, you'll have like a chip that grows neurons and gives your computer an additional, let's say, brain, so something like that. I think that the entire field of unconventional computing that is by itself somehow ill-defined as well, probably comes out of sort of a frustration that with the current computers and the current knowledge and approaches we have, we haven't gone as far as we imagined. Like, we still don't have a computer that learns in an open-ended way. Well, maybe we'll never have one like we like to have, but we would like to go a little further, have machines that adapt much more in an open-ended fashion,
mm-hmm.
More robust machines, things like that. And these things are very hard to achieve with the approaches we have with the traditional silicon, if you want. Yeah, probably this frustration that we haven't achieved the goals, also if you want to talk about artificial intelligence and things like that, to search for alternative solutions and try different things that might, based on a different computational substrate, have different properties, maybe better properties. So that's the motivation behind unconventional computing in general.
Do you imagine the biological sort of intermixing with the electronic models?
Yeah, I think that's a very hot topic right now, and it's going to be much more important in the near future. So the interface between biology, computer science, and nanotech, molecular electronics. So maybe by putting together all these things, all the findings we have from neuroscience and from computer science and from nanotech, so putting these things together, maybe that's sufficient to get better machines, bigger machines, machines that scale better, more intelligent machines, whatever this means, if we want to come back to lifelike, the definition of lifelike, so machines that have properties that are more similar to what animals or humans,
living organisms,
compute or do. So yeah, that's probably the future, I will say.
What kind of interface are we looking at for connecting between biology and silicon?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, really working at the interface. As I said, maybe hybrid machines, combined.
How would that work exactly, is what I'm wondering.
Nano machines that can move atoms, molecules, build small structures, things like that.
Okay.
It sounds a little scary, but I think that's really where research goes, actually.
Doesn't sound scary at all. It sounds really exciting.
Yeah, it depends on which side you are.
What your perspective
is,
right?
I'm not scared at all, but some
people are. So, moving forward a little bit with the unconventional computing thing, could you explain sort of the von Neumann computer architecture and what's wrong with that model?
Well, wrong is maybe the wrong word, or it's pretty strong.
What's insufficient?
If you take a look at today's computers, most people are probably pretty happy with what they have, and I'm pretty sure that what you have on your desk, machines you have on your desk, and computers, they're not going to be replaced in the next 10 years or so. But one of the problems of these computers is that they're mostly not parallel machines. So you have always a bottleneck, and instructions have to go through that bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably the main reason why the von Neumann architecture is sort of gives a limit, at least, to the scalability we can achieve. But again, if you put together like many parallel machines, many simple processing elements, you're going to have other bottlenecks. Usually, it's you problem is then is to how to communicate between these elements. So you're going to have a trade-off again. So I wouldn't say different human architecture is totally wrong. It's good for many, many applications, but there might be many other, there are of course many applications where a massive parallel architecture that is not based on a von Neumann architecture performs much better. So yeah.
For example, what do you imagine it being used for?
Yeah, it's always a little difficult to imagine applications directly, but you can imagine, for example, there is the amorphous computing project at MIT, for example, and they imagine that so-called paintable computer. Imagine you would put in a paint like billions of tiny processing elements, and then you would just paint your walls. So you basically, you'll have billions of processing elements distributed on your walls, and then you can imagine like computing different things in that with that computer, like measuring temperature, which is probably not very useful. But there are applications in these, I'd say maybe unconventional ways to compute or to measure different things in like sensor networks. You want to measure like different distributions of chemical in the atmosphere or things like that. So I think unconventional computers have to be used in unconventional environments and unconventional for unconventional applications as well.
It seems like in terms of investigating life and lifelike properties of systems, they could be very useful.
Yeah. I think I fully agree with that. I mean, it's fundamental research, and you don't necessarily have to have, like, an application in mind. It's sufficient, in my opinion, to have the curiosity and fun to investigate an unconventional machine or way to compute or way to build a machine. And then if it's worth something, we're going to have applications someday. So if we start worrying about applications and things like that first, then we're just going to slow down progress. So, yeah, that's my opinion.
And at what point would you consider a machine to be alive?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. There are many ways of defining alive. I think there are some common agreements that life has usually some sort of self-replicating or self-reproducing elements. So something that doesn't self-replicate or self-reproduce is usually not considered as something alive. But defining life itself is almost as difficult as defining intelligence, as defining consciousness, things like that. So it's a pretty ill-defined concept. Some people consider like or say that everything that is alive has to be carbon based, and nothing in a machine can ever be alive. But you can find other definitions of life. That includes like something that adapts, something that learns, something that has a metabolism. Usually computers don't have that, so it's really hard to define what life is, and equally with what intelligence is and things like that.
Does it seem like just a semantic problem, or does it seem like it's something of significance to try to understand?
I think yes, certainly it's a semantic problem as well. I don't worry too much about these definitions. The reason is maybe that whatever definition you have, you can find another one that is just different, is maybe not better. But the problems, the fundamental problems remain the same. You want to have machines that adapt better to changing environments. Whether you consider that machine finally as a machine that is alive or not doesn't really matter.
That's interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about your poetic machines that combine evolution, development, and learning?
Right. So evolution, development, and learning are sort of three adaptive principles we find on Earth in nature on different timescales. And I think we might consider them as really important. So the poetic project was, the goal was to combine these three forms of adaptation, roughly evolution, which is the adaptation of populations to a changing environment, and development, which is the development of an individual from one single cell to a multicellular organism, and learning, which is this form of adaptation during the lifetime of an individual. So by combining these three forms of adaptation together, it has been shown many times that we can build more robust machines that are more adaptive, so sort of more powerful. Especially with, robots is a good example of robots that use genetic algorithms and learning and some sort of developmental principles usually perform better than when you just use genetic algorithms or neural networks alone. So the hope was to, by combining these three forms together within a chip again, but not on a huge, large scale demonstrator this time. It's just building a silicon chip that this, I would say, also unconventional way of building computers might result in properties that are different and more interesting, more powerful than the von Neumann computer you have on your desk.
Mm-hmm.
So before we run out of time, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your research on Alan Turing?
Sure. So Alan Turing is, of course, related to many aspects of my work. I mean, he's usually considered as the father of computer science, including artificial intelligence, artificial life.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of proposed genetic algorithms even. So he's definitely a very, very interesting man. And as a computer scientist, I knew Turing basically from the Turing machine, which is the abstract computational model which every computer is sort of based upon, even though it's not a direct implementation of the Turing machine. But the Turing machine is really the fundamental thing in computer science, in theoretical computer science, at least.
Could you explain what the Turing machine is?
So, it's an abstract computing device, basically composed of a tape that can move, and a head, a reasoned write head that can write and read symbols on that tape. And the Turing machine is so fundamental that it can basically compute anything you can compute with any machine. So everything computable can be reduced to Turing machine. It's extremely simple, but of course no one would ever implement directly a Turing machine with a tape that moves or whatever. That would be totally inefficient. But you can
reduce kind of beautiful,
the
though.
Computations you can do with your whatever machine. If it's a parallel machine, you can reduce these operations to this extremely simple operations of a Turing machine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an extremely powerful concept.
And we don't normally associate Turing with connectionism, but it sounds like you've done some research in this
area. Right. Yeah, so Turing, in 1948, he published that paper, Intelligent Machinery, which was basically undiscovered for many years. And there was an article in the Scientific American some years ago, which I read with a lot of interest, and then I started getting really excited about that and started reading things. And it really turns out that Alan Turing had fundamental ideas about how we could build machines that are more like brains, so putting together a large number of elements in a more or less random way, and then start organizing the connections and things like that. So that was Turing's idea, and it's pretty amazing how early he had these ideas. And in addition to this abstract Turing machine ideas, so he basically said that an infant is an unorganized machine. So you take a bunch of components, you randomly interconnect them, and then you start organizing this infant. Or he compared that with like teaching an infant. That is something that is many people know Turing, but most people just don't know that he also proposed connectionist networks.
And how do his thoughts sort of mesh with current connectionist research?
The processing elements Turing proposed were, of course, very, very simple and not biologically plausible. So with all the knowledge we have from neuroscience now, that was just a rather naive idea, of course, but he didn't know better. So he took this very simple NAND. So NAND is a not AND computational element, which is universal in the sense that with a set of NAND components, you can build any machine. And that's the reason why he chosen those components, because he knew they were universal, and he, by just assembling them in a certain way, he could even build a Turing machine or a Turing equivalent machine.
Just with the assembly of NAND gates.
Yeah, as I said, with current knowledge we have in neuroscience, we know that neurons are much more complex than just such a simple logic gate Turing proposed. But still, I mean, the basic idea that you have a large number of elements, you interconnect them, and then the connections get modified by training the network, that's still the same. So, even 50 years later.
And are you working with connectionist ideas as well?
Yeah, sure. That goes directly into the project, like the Poetic Project, where you have genetic algorithms, neural networks, so connectionist networks, and developmental algorithms. Imagine like you have an artificial genome that specifies how you build an artificial neural network, then you build that network, and you put that on a robot, and the robot starts moving around and learns in an environment, things like that. Of course, that involves a lot of neural networks and connectionist networks.
That's really interesting. So how much have you gotten to actually test these out on real robotic machines?
Not that often. The problem is that you can do a lot of simulations, and testing on a real robot is usually necessary, but it takes a lot of time, especially with genetic algorithms.
Right.
You spend like days and days just running several individuals and testing them in an environment. So that's a major drawback. But of course, it's always the ultimate goal to end up with a real machine, and that works in a real environment, and not just in a simulation that is usually so abstract that say, well, it's not realistic at all, and mm-hmm. you have like three inputs and two motors and things like that.
Right.
But in reality, it's totally different, and you have a much more complex environment usually. But you start with simulations, and then if these simulations work well, then you go ahead and put them on a robot or any other embedded machine.
So what's coming up? What are you working on in the future?
So right now I worked for almost a year on case following and shared attention in infants, and how we can model these developmental stages, which are considered to be very important. In general, how the infant as a metaphor for developing complex system is really appealing. So if we know more about infant and are able to model the different developmental stages of an infant, that gives us an insight, or can give us an insight on how the infant works, of course,
mm-hmm.
by modeling these phenomena. And we can use the models then to make machines more lifelike again. So if for example, you can build a robot that follows the gaze of his teacher or whatever, that might be considered as a major step towards a machine that is more interactive with its environment, for example. So again, drawing inspiration from nature, from humans, from animals, apply these insights to machines for making them more intelligent. That's the key, the central point of my research, I think.
Well, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And again, combining biology with computer science, building models, testing models, trying to fit the models to behavioral data and things like that. That's really interesting, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners before we part?
So, yeah, thanks so much for having me in your show. And I think if someone is interested in my work, he might want to check my website. If I remember right, there's a link already on the different bits.
There is indeed.
So thanks so much for having me.
Okay, great. Well, have a good day, and keep in touch.